by gravity and supernova.
We can just sit here, because otherwise I can't see what. Actually, it reminds me of the airplane. They had only two screens, and my neck was burning like hell. Oh, hi, Konstantinos. So, yes. This is probably, well, it's very hard for me to give a talk here, because I work a lot these days on Zinyard-Seldovich effect, and I don't think, apart from Justin, anybody else seems interested in that. So I decided to talk on something I actually did a while back in collaboration with Olga Mena and Jose Santiago. That was when I was in Fermilab. Jose is still there. Olga had moved on to Rome now. And basically, what there were a couple of papers at that time to use. I have to stand here, otherwise I can't really see my own talk, which is really bad, because I don't remember what I wanted to say. So basically, what we wanted to discuss, look into is how to use astrophysical probes to constrain these models. And today I want to talk about mainly what to do with supernovae, which is actually quite tricky to do with these models. So this is just sort of the reminder of what sort of the standard picture of cosmology is today, sometimes called the concordance model. Basically, that we have 4% baryonic matter, 21% in dark matter, and 75% in whatever that is, dark energy or something else. And that seems to be confirmed more and more by various observations, various different groups. Right. So this is sort of the historical slide which drove all this interest in models of expanding, of accelerated expansion of the universe. So what's plotted here is a distance redshift plot, if you want, as measured with type 1a supernovae. So this scale here is the distance in some units, and here's redshift between 0 and 1. And probably for you guys, quite interesting is, so this is a picture of a supernova in a host galaxy, and you see how bright this object is, which allows you to observe it to quite large distances and hence get a large lever arm on this redshift distance diagram. And at the time, basically, the standard cosmological model was a flat universe just containing dark matter, and this is described by this curve down here, which is sort of normalized by this low redshift supernova, and you see it falls systematically short of these data points here. And one way to interpret this, if you think about this as a receding velocity, and you go, and this is, you fix the distance and you go over here, you actually see, if you assume a certain Hubble parameter today, you would predict for a flat standard cold dark matter universe a faster receding velocity than you actually observe. So it's slower. So in order to come from the slower velocity today, you need accelerated expansion. Right. And the simplest explanation in terms, well, at least for an astrophysicist, is just to throw in a cosmological constant in this data set, and that seems to be more or less consistent with all these data sets. And then you're getting into problems to explain the value of the cosmological constant. Why is it so small? And also, but this is actually entirely related to the same problem. Why is it roughly of the same order, the density in the cosmological constant, as it is in matter? Right. So, and basically, when people discovered that, they said, well, let's move away from this and say, let's say there's a fluid in the universe which is governed by a simple equation of state where the pressure is related by proportionality to the density, and this factor is, let's say, for the moment constant. And if you do a simple exercise and calculate this, the deceleration parameter in a flat universe which has only dark energy, you see the W has to be smaller than minus a third in order to get accelerated expansion. Okay? If you have matter in the universe, this is actually lower. Right. Now, one way, well, not really to explain this, that would be too strong, to model that is motivated by knowledge how you model a phase of accelerated expansion in the early universe. You might want to throw in a scalar field, which either rolls down very slowly the potential, or is trapped in a local minimum. And this is usually explored in the context of inflation for the early universe. And I think, you know, the involved energy scales to explain inflation are much more natural than here. However, you can also study these scenarios for late time. Sorry, I'm just in front here. For late time scenarios, which I think was first done Rutter and Peoples and Vetterich in the late 80s. And I guess back then it was merely an academic exercise. And basically, you see if you can sort of neglect the kinetic energy part of this equation of state goes towards minus one and behaves like a constant. And the first simplest potential to try this was a pure exponential potential, which has certain nice properties. It has an attractive solution. It doesn't need fine-tuning of the initial conditions. Of course, you still have to adjust a bit the terms and the amplitude of the potential and the exponent. Unfortunately, the attractor regime in these models always gives you that the amount of dark energy today is less than matter. Otherwise, I think this would be a really attractive dark energy model, but it doesn't work with the data. And then people started modifying this. This was actually also, these potentials were also discussed in the early papers by Rutter and Peebles. And you get models which allow dark energy domination today. Right. This is not important. This is the equation of state at late redshifts. Now, all these models basically are made up ad hoc entirely, I think. There's no one to believe more than the other. I mean, some are a bit more coupled to fundamental physics, but I think more or less all of them are made up ad hoc. So then an idea was looked at as something completely different. So all we want to explain is accelerated expansion of the universe. So far we have only fiddled with entries in the energy momentum tensor in the Einstein equations. But maybe you want to play around with the left-hand side, and this is, you know, you can sort of assume maybe gravity is standard at short distances, but gets modified on large distances, so it behaves different from what we have measured really well, let's say within the solar system. But we don't have any other measurements apart from these cosmological ones at hundreds of megaparsecs. And so, it's actually quite good talking about this here, and I don't have to explain this too well. So basically, what you look into then is sort of general gravitational actions, and of course you have to be very careful when you do that. So you take scalar invariance of the Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor, Riemann tensor, and this is actually motivated by, again, by some inflationary models. So the next simplest approach you can do is sort of adding a power law in the Ricci scalar to your linear Ricci scalar term. And if you do that, this was actually explored in the early 80s, as far as I know, which is known as Starobinsky inflation. And basically what he found is that if n is larger than 1, you get an early visitor phase and exponential expansion in the early universe. Now what we want is, we want to have this at late times in very large scales, so you can think about, well, instead of having n larger than 1, I choose n smaller than 0, so I get 1 over r terms, and hence at large distances, which are fairly flat, or at late times when the universe is large, this term becomes important. By doing so, I think, but I don't know too much about this, at this stage, this was sort of motivated as an effective action, while if you do that, I don't think there's any, as far as I know, motivation for an effective action which has n smaller than zero. But if somebody knows that, nothing wrong. And again, this modification, as I said, becomes important at low curvature and can lead to accelerated expansion. And these are various groups which have explored these models. And this is for the simplest one of them, that is the Friedmann equation. So in terms of the Hubble parameters, this is second order differential equation. But if you think about it in terms of the scale factors, it's actually fourth order differential equation you have to solve. And that makes the thing very difficult, actually. And the source term here, as you see, is only matter. You don't need any dark energy or cosmology constant. And please, I beg you not to ask me why lambda is zero in these models. You can always do that when you come up with an alternative for cosmology constant. You can always ask them why is this zero in your model. Right, so the simplest extension in that regard was this 1 over R model, which when you do the dynamical systems analysis, you find it has an accelerated attractor. So here's the phase diagram, the derivative of the Hubble parameter and the Hubble parameter. So this point here is the de Sitter point where the Hubble parameter stays constant and that is unstable. And if you do the analysis, you actually find, well, three different types of solutions, this unstable de Sitter point. You find some solutions which hit a future singularity and some which give rise to power law acceleration at late times. And that was, well, the appealing finding. However, one thing which is sort of swept a bit under the carpet is this constant here, or when I go back here, this constant basically in front of this term. You have to adjust that as well. And as you can imagine, well, you always have to put the scale into the problem that you want this term to dominate. So this is a very small number, again, as you need with the cosmological constant, and I think with almost everything else. OK, so if you would look at this model, this would correspond to a dark energy model with an equation of state of minus 2/3. So if you want to compare the observation consequences of that. Now, there's a problem with that. If you look at general f of r actions, and well, let's first look at these more generalized actions where you have inverse powers to the n of the Ricci scalar. And if you do that, you can do the dynamical system analysis. And you find that late times, this system behaves like a dark energy model, which has an equation of state which behaves like this. So the larger you make n, the closer you get to the minus 1. Right, and as you can imagine, this can satisfy the observational constraints coming from supernova. However, as I said before, when you fiddle around with gravity, you have to be very careful because there are a lot of tests and you don't want to violate them. So these f of r theories, you can actually phrase them as scalar tensor theories. Or in terms of a general Brown Stigett theory, this would be where you have this scalar coupled to the this scalar field coupled to the Ricci scalar, and here a potential term, and these models have been actually tested with observations in the solar system to great detail. And if we phrase our models in this framework, we actually find that these models behave like a Brown Stigett theory where this omega parameter is exactly zero. And that is the problem, because this parameter is actually constrained. Let's say, I mean, you can take different types of constraints, but let's say you take how light of quasars is deflected by the sun, you find a constraint on this omega to be larger than 35,000. So it's definitely not zero. So that would rule out these models from a solar system test point of view. However, you can generalize these models, as I said before, but now they get nastier and nastier. So, let's say the next simplest thing you can do is you add, the square of the Ricci scalar, the square of the Ricci tensor, and the square of the Riemann tensor, and you have these sort of, at the moment, these arbitrary parameters in front that you have different combinations. And again, you have a scale you have to adjust. If you look at these models, you again find an unstable de Sitter solution. In order for the corrections to be negligible in the past but dominant today and to get acceleration today, again, you have to adjust this small parameter here. And basically, the Hubble parameter today is driving that, or if you want, the age of the universe. And again, if you do a dynamical system analysis for these types of models, you find a late time acceleration vector. As an example, let's say the next simplest thing is instead of having 1 over r, you do 1 over Ricci tensor square. And if you do that again, here's the phase diagram, time derivative of the Hubble parameter versus the Hubble parameter. 0 is here, so this is the unstable de Sitter point. But what you also actually find, you find now two branches with late time attractors, and only one of them is accelerating. Okay? And one is decelerating. So that has consequences for later. Right. Now, if you add explicit dependencies of the Ricci tensor and Riemann tensor to your action, if you start sort of doing linear perturbations in your actions, you sort of can look at the way I understand it, as a particle spectrum of these theories, and you can study the appearance of ghosts. I'm by no means an expert on this, so I'm just conveying this result to you. So basically, when you do this expansion, you know, you find a constant term, a term linear to the Ricci scalar, a term proportional to the square of the Ricci scalar, but then you also find a term proportional to the Weyl tensor, and that can give rise to ghosts. Now, what these guys have looked at in these terms and what they found is if you have a certain combination of this Riemann tensor square and Ricci tensor square, meaning C is equal minus 4B, so let's have this go back. So this is actually more general what I write here, so let me, it says I'm chalk here. So, you know, the usual definition is that you define P in this term and Q, well, is the square of the Riemann tensor. What you have actually find is any function you add, which is f of r and I think q minus 4p, any function like this doesn't have these ghosts. So what you look at when you have this linearization of the model, you look at the mass term in front of the Weyl tensor, and if you have this combination, that the Weyl tensor contribution actually is vanishing. So you don't expect massive spin 2 excitations and hence no ghosts. But as I said,
if you go to higher orders, what you say is no longer true.
Possible.
Not possible.
Possible. Well, possible includes true.
Possible includes not true.
Yes, well, possible includes, I don't know, okay. So, but I find this quite intriguing because this is actually the combination you get also in Gauss-Bonnet terms. Now, this is a function of Gauss-Bonnet, which for me doesn't have any deeper meaning. I mean, Gauss-Bonnet, it's obviously nothing is happening for the Gauss-Bonnet combination. Right. Okay, that's what these guys found. However, there's still a problem that you can have modes propagating as tachyons in these. You haven't looked at all the combinations yet, and I guess in 1 or 2 weeks you have Mark Frong coming here, and I bet he will tell you a lot about that. So basically, this is necessary, but it's not a sufficient condition for positive Einstein space. So I think this is still different from what you were saying. Right? This is not the statement you were making.
No, this is a different.
Yeah.
This is another kind of disease.
Right. So what these guys found is that quite a lot of these models have this disease, but there are still some branches of the parameter space which don't have the tachyonic modes. Unfortunately, for the simplest models I'm showing you, they are basically have this tachyonic mode. So you have to go to higher inverse powers, and then the allowed ranges which fit the supernova data and give accelerated expansion today and don't have these tachyons are coming together. Right. Now moving on to solar systems tests. What happens in these models is, let's say we do a linear expansion around the Schwarzschild metric, then you find corrections to the Newtonian potential, which basically the corrections break down at a critical radius, or the corrections become of order one. And if you look at the solar system, you find actually when you plug in all the parameters in the right order of magnitude that you get accelerated expansion today, you get 10 parsecs, so way outside the solar system. So these models aren't constrained by any solar system tests. If you plug in galaxies, you end up at 100 kiloparsecs. That's getting already possibly tricky if you, I don't know, you might think about using tidal streamers at the edge of the galaxies to test gravity. And then for clusters, this radius becomes actually a megaparsec. So you could potentially, let's say you have a cluster which is in equilibrium, where the kinetic energy is tightly related to the potential energy, you could try to test these models with that. Unfortunately, in order to use that, you need this solution is breaking down at this radius, and nobody has managed so far to write down an exact spherical symmetric solution for these models. So, right. So this is sort of all the background for these models. So what we did is we wanted to see how supernovae really constrain these models. So you have to study the modified Friedmann equations, and they are actually a nightmare. So the black part is what you usually have in the Friedmann equation, which is sort of an algebraic equation. But then, as I said before, in terms of the Hubble parameter, you pick up a second order differential equation. Now, it turns out this is actually a stiff problem, because if you want to adjust, you know, you have matter and radiation in your early universe, and then the accelerated expansion today, you sort of have to fiddle around with two scales, and you can never make both of them small simultaneously. So we tried a lot of off-the-shelf differential equation solvers. None of them worked, which probably tells you something about the system as well. The other thing is that as a source term now, there's only matter and no cosmological constant. And if you want to study the dynamics of this system I introduced before, it actually turns out there are three parameters which define the dynamics of this system. So this is this parameter alpha, which is a combination of ABC, then the sort of a renormalized scale, mu, and then a psi. And when you look at that, you can actually find four special values where the dynamical behavior of this system is changing, and you can get all of this analytical. In principle, if alpha is smaller than alpha 1, both values of the sine are acceptable. If you choose alpha in the range between alpha 1 and alpha 2, the positive sign actually is hitting a singularity in the past. Something similar happens for this range, just with the opposite sign. And then it gets a bit more tricky. For alpha between alpha 2 and alpha 3, there's a stable attractor that is decelerated for this range and accelerated for large alpha. But the data will tell us that, so there's no intrinsic problem. And then in the last range, there's no longer a stable attractor, but in general, the singularity is reached in the future, so you could argue we don't care about this right now from a data point of view, so you can still try and fit the data. However, this depends how much matter there is in the universe, and so it might appear also in the past. So all these parameters are interconnected. So, as I said before, we couldn't really solve this differential equation for arbitrary initial conditions. So what we said, in order to have a cosmological viable model, we started out with a solution very close to an Einstein digital universe consisting of radiation and matter in the early universe. And we found an approximate analytic solution in the distant past. And basically what you do is, so what the little E here means, a standardized digital solution, and these are the corrections coming in from this modified Friedmann equations. Okay, so, and this approximation works quite well, and you can sort of do this perturbation analysis of the differential equation. So what we did is we chose our initial conditions very close to radiation-dominated universe early on. And then we went backwards, and we saw that correction gets smaller and smaller. And then we go forwards in time, and we have to constantly check that this correction is small. And you get actually three conditions at this correction. So this is a correction in the past. So e to the x is basically the scale factor. So you see this is driven by the scale factor to the power of, well, 8. Okay. So what you do then is you go forwards in time, and you constantly check these constraints and make sure you don't violate these constraints. And at some stage, the acceleration takes over, and you violate it. So as a specific example for our best fit model, this is violated at a scale factor of 0.2. Okay? So in general, these three conditions break down at this scale factor values. Now, the good thing is, at these late times, we can actually do the exact numerical solutions. The system is stable enough at late times to do that. So what you do is you take this early, this approximation as early solution, and then way back when these conditions are still fulfilled, let's say at redshift 10 or so, you take this approximate solution as an initial condition for your numerical solution, and you can solve the system. So what I'm plotting here is the best fit model. This V is basically the power law, scale factor evolves with time, and you see, so early on this behaves like radiation, and then it hits a matter phase, and then it starts accelerating today. For comparison, I plot what a lambda CDM model would give in that plane, and you see actually in these models we have a longer matter phase. Okay, so there might be additional constraints from that. Now there's quite a debate about this in the literature, mainly driven by Luca Amendola, which claims you don't get a matter phase at all. Now, he has a different sign in front of the term which you add in the action than we have. And that makes all the difference. Okay, so it hasn't really been resolved yet, but if you read his paper very careful, he actually mentions in a couple of sentences, yeah, you can have another sign and then you don't have this problem. But you have to fine-tune the initial conditions, and that's exactly what we do, because we fine-tune our initial conditions to sit close to the Einstein de Sitter universe. Okay. Right. So this is the solution of this system. So basically what I plot here is the Hubble parameter versus redshift, and you see, so here I plot the true solution, or the numerical solution, over the approximate solution, and you see, you know, at some stage, approximation breaks down, okay? This is sort of the percentage difference. So what we do is we match the solutions when the agreement is better than 0.1%. And once you do that, then you can start trying to constrain these models with supernova data. Now, the first thing you have to notice, usually, because the supernova has this arbitrary intrinsic magnitude, so you can't really measure H naught from supernovae alone because that's entirely degenerate with the intrinsic magnitude. So basically, you have to phrase all your quantities you want to observe in units of H naught, and that is for standard cosmology. And here, basically, the dimensionful quantities in units of this mu, which takes over the role of H naught. And the remaining parameters are then alpha and the matter contents normalized by that. Now, the first thing you will notice then when you do this game, that alpha smaller than alpha 1 leads to very bad fits. And you're left over basically with two regions which potentially fit the supernova data. And they have a different sign, basically. So this was this combination of A, B, and C. the sign of that. Okay, so you get two regions which potentially can fit the supernova data. And that is what you find. So what's plotted here is, to some extent, the meta-contents in some normalized by this mu hat and the alpha value. So you get two regions where supernova data fit very well. These are 1 and 2 sigma contours. If you want to argue in terms of chi-square, well, these are the chi-square values for the best fit models in these two regions. For comparison, this is a value for the lambda CDM model, which has one parameter less than these models. Now, there's some region you have to rule out by hand, basically. So what's happening here in this, well, I don't know how to describe this color. It looks like a pig or something. Basically, what's happening here is the singularity of this dynamical system is hit after the last supernova data point. The supernova can live with this cosmology, but we can't. Okay, so you have to take that off by hand because the data doesn't tell you that.
Wait, so this is a quick clarification. You have one more parameter that you're fitting than alpha.
Yeah, this alpha.
So you actually have the worst.
Yes, that's what I tried.
Yeah. You also presume you have flat neighbors only in the first one?
Yes. Well, I don't know how complicated. It might get very complicated, so there might be a strong reason. Okay. Right, so the next thing you can do is, in order to set this late time scale of the mu, you can either use a prior on the Hubble parameter or something like prior on the age of the universe coming from globular clusters. And then you can start constraining this mu hat and the physical matter content in the universe, and you sort of have to split up these two regions which have different signs. And basically what you see here is that I give this mu hat in kilometers per second per megaparsec. This is roughly of the order of the Hubble parameter as you would have expected in the first place. So one thing to notice, you know, you still need dark matter in these models, of course. Okay, so you don't get rid of dark matter to get the supernova data. Now, when we submitted that, the referee actually asked us if we want to include in a simple fashion the CMB, and we refused to do that. I mean, I call it CMB for the brave. Basically, what he wanted us to do is just take the angular diameter distance to the last scattering surface. But you can do that. It's a simple exercise. But you have to do a full perturbation analysis in order to see that this system doesn't blow up in your face when you do that. Okay, so you can do this exercise, and I'm plotting this very weak. I'm only showing this in talks. You get better constraints, but this might be complete nonsense. Okay, so having said that, people have started to look into the perturbation regime of, well, related models, not exactly this one. And so this is one finding by Bean and collaborators for one of our models. And actually, this is one of the examples which has the wrong sign, unfortunately. And I asked Rachel to do it for the other sign, but for some reason, because they go to the scalar tensor frame, she cannot do that. But basically, what they find is, so they calculate CMB perturbations and the meta power spectrum, and there are big problems to fit simultaneously small scale data with large scale CMB data in these models. A similar work by Song Hu and Sawicki, which also looked at slightly different classes of these models, but you see there are effects on large scale CMB and large effects on the power of the power spectrum, so this might be degenerate with a bias. So from an astrophysical point of view, this is most likely to be a showstopper for these models, but all these models have, to some extent, the wrong sign from what we find, what fits supernova data best. So let me conclude. The inverse curvature gravity models can lead to accelerated expansion of the universe and explain supernova data and some violation of solar system tests. And there's no need for dark energy in that context. Obviously, the other probes are most likely more powerful, but they need careful analysis of the perturbation regime. And nobody has done yet the perturbation regime in these more general models, because you can't go simply to a scalar tensor theory with a conformal transformation. You don't gain anything by that, unfortunately, for these more general models. It's no alternative for dark matter. So some people have claimed if you, instead of taking inverse function, a logarithmic function, you can actually start also fitting rotation curves with these models. But I'm not going there. I leave this to John. So the model versus dark energy. And I think that's probably the most interesting thing to look at. First of all, you require also a small parameter mu. Possibly you require a large N for more physical models which don't suffer the tachyonic excitations. I'm very suspicious that the truly ghost-free versions, if, let's say, that exists, well, this only has, by definition, then a scalar degree of freedom, and there might be a simple scalar tensor theory. And so one thing you find when you do a conformal transformation, it looks a bit like a scalar tensor theory. And in addition, you have a scalar coupled to a Gauss-Bonnet term. So maybe, you know, to some extent, we're all talking about the same, that these are, to some extent, dark energy models which are coupled by some means to the matter contents of the system. So it might be all the same anyway, if it's truly physical. And of course, there is no motivation for this model. And there's this famous quote. Okay. Thanks.
Parameter
is of
the Hubble scale, not the
present
density scale, which is even worse, right?
Well, isn't that related,
right? Yeah,
yeah. But it's not density, it's, I gave it in electron volts, not in electron volts to the four, so. Okay.
Yeah, but it's like 10 to the minus 30.
Exactly.
Not 10 to the minus 3 or 4.
Yeah.
You haven't mentioned yet another model for accelerating the universe, namely the exact solutions of Einstein's field equations for late time in 1980.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In which case you don't have to modify Einstein at all.
Right.
And there's a lot of controversy about this, but it's got as much hope as this has, it might be.
Well, I think it might have more hope, but coming up. The way I see these models, you have to come up sort of with a natural explanation for some boundary conditions or something like that, and that is the tricky thing.
Yeah, but the late time solution does not have a constant spot built in from the beginning. It's the only one I know of in which there really is a constant spot. But in these models, you still have a fine tuning to get rid of the constant spot. Why now?
Mm-hmm.
For all the other models, except
for the principle. But with the inhomogeneous models, don't you shuffle that into the scale of inhomogeneities?
If you solve Einstein's field equations, you can.
But there must be a scale involved.
The scale is that when you remove the galaxies and the voids, late time inhomogeneity, you will not see any acceleration. And so happens the acceleration starts when the nonlinear regime in the universe begins to be seen, which is not possible.
So how do you make sure that doesn't happen earlier?
Because in these exact solutions, they become FRW as you go back in time, naturally, still into the solution. The problem with all this is that there must be half a dozen models. I have two or three myself, and they're all different. And they all claim to fit the data. Some are diseased and some aren't. These are diseased, in my opinion.
No.
You have to keep a very tight set of conditions as to what you accept and don't accept. Because you're trying to compete with Einstein, it's not easy.
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to talk about that. I leave that to Shuhal.
I didn't mean that as a joke.
I did.
Actually, I have a technical question.
Okay.
So, did you try to use the Yankee identity to try and solve the equation?
Well, you use energy conservation anyway already. I don't use the fourth order scale. Because you can show, you know, the components have energy conservation, so you use that.
Okay. And even then, it's a magnet.
Yeah.
The models that you have tachyons, what's the mass of the tachyon compared to Hubble? Yeah. Because, I mean, naively, quintessence models have tachyons as well.
Okay. As I said, I bet Mark would talk about it. He's on this paper, so.
So I'm the same exactly on the other side of John. I don't see what the problem is with girls and all this stuff. I mean, no one told you to quantize this theory. No one told you to look at the most fundamental theory.
Well, that's what my collaborator Jose is saying. He says it's just effective.
I wouldn't lose sleep over that. I don't lose sleep over anything.
Yeah, you don't have faith. Well, as far as I know. I better stop.
I'm being very quiet.
There is a comment about that, which is Charles saying you're supposed to use quantum mechanics to see the first unitarity violation, blah, blah. But when you space it on a differential equation, which is higher than second order, you've got real problems at the classical level, because you have runaway solutions. It's unstable.
Well, to some extent, that's what I meant. Yes. When we had such troubles finding a solution, I'm sort of halfway convinced that actually has a deeper physical meaning. It's not just a numerical
but
problem.
It's about extrapolation. So of course, you have pathological regimes and so on. But I'll give you an example that the Euler-Eisenberg Hamiltonian, or Lagrangian, she's like incorporating quantum effects. You get a fourth order. Well, it's fine. I mean, you're not going to be using it in situations where you get runaway solution. Mm-hmm. I mean, these things are not fundamental. I mean, no one is saying this is a new relativity.
Okay. But why are we doing it in that case?
Because it's just for the same.
Well, I think both of you are right, actually. But we are so clueless of all these things. We just have to play along.
There's a big difference, of course, with electron mask, that's the nature once you make the moons.
But here it's
hard to write an effective theory that would do that, right? So the groups or whatever, it should be the size of the universe or something like that.
Yeah.